Fred Copeman, Reel 2.
So over the top we went. And everybody kind of got mixed up. Now, I kept my section, because I still had my section, but there were now a section of number one company, which had returned from Madrid and joined the battalion. So we had about 660 men in the battalion, in four companies. The number one company was one, with the lads that turned up from Madrid, plus my section of about 40. And Kit Conway was our company commander. And he said to me, look, Fred, you just do what you think's right. Just keep them together. And don't take notes of me. And if you think I'm doing anything wrong, say so. Now, this was a lad who had already been in the line. It was a good one. He was Irish, but he hadn't joined the Yanks. And away we went. I must have gone about 3 miles over this rough country, then through an olive grove, where there was a French 7.5 battery belt in hell. First time I heard a gunfire on land. And then just past the battery, start to hear funny little noises, you know, tch, and a leaf would drop out of a tree, and I thought, oh, I knew bloody well what it was. Nobody else knew what it was. I said to the fella next to me, what's that noise? I said, it's crickets. A lot of crickets in Spain, you know. I was already getting worried. And then, of course, a few hundred yards more, there was more bloody leaves were falling. We were in it. And then lads start to fall down. And we came to a road, a little sunken road. And kind of held things up. Blokes were getting killed. And they all started to pile into the road because it was down. And old Kit Conway was bawling, you know, for me to get out. Nobody was taking much notice. So I came up and said to my lads, look, lad, don't hang around here, mate. This is a bloody deathbed. They get over the top with good green grass. Look, you can see the bloody valley. Hop up and have a look. So my lads went and all the others followed. By this time, they were all spread out. It was obvious number one company was on the left, but once you got past that, they were all just a huge crowd. They got like a bloody summer outing. And then there was a slight slope. It was all olive groves behind us. We'd gone through those, and then there was a slope with nothing on it. It came to a wall about 2 foot high and about 2 foot thick, stone wall. And then down rock and into a valley of grass, lovely. Could have been more than a mile wide, with two little mounds in the middle. Now, by now, we were getting it, because they could see us, and we were on a slope towards them.
And where was the shell fire coming from?
At that time, it was coming from the front. So I said to my blokes, now run, get the other side of that left-hand mound, and then stop. So away we went. Then everybody started to run. Half of them started to follow us, and I said, look, piss off. Keep going. You're bloody straight all over the bloody show. And old Kit Conway was leading from the front like a bloody sergeant major with a walking stick, you know. It was still lovely. He kept going. So the others kept going. So here was our 40 stuck on that side of the little slope and facing forward. And there's nobody on our left, so that was the end of the front. We were right on the left-hand flank of the whole of the front for that battle for the Madrid-Valencia Road. It was all rocks and hills that way. You couldn't even ride a horse through it. So we got there. And must have been there half an hour. By this time, we'd lost only half a battalion. They were forming like bloody. So I had me binoculars. And I got up, looking through them binoculars. And a bloody bullet hit a lad, Bill Wright, an old carpenter bloke, came up to me and said he's over 65. I said, what the bloody hell are you doing here? You're supposed to be building bloody stalls for the best room. Oh, he said, I'll come out of this, Fred. And just as he said it, plop, bloody bullet hit him in the back of the head. And Why the hell it didn't hit me? I think he was a bit taller than me. That's why it went over. Anyway, it would have been spent, and he was dead. But it came from over here.
So, over to the right?
Yes, and behind us. So I'd put me bloody binoculars around, and the notion had got him up, and a bloody bullet hit me in the wristwatch and went through there. You still see the mark, you see the little old scar there. Didn't feel anything. There were six tanks on a road going round the bed on the Maratha Road. Obviously knocked out. Weren't doing anything. And there was troops on the other side of them, on the slope. That was a Dimitrov battalion and the Tailman battalion. They'd retired, they'd run, and Frank had gone by us. So here we were again. Started off. It never ended in the war. We always found ourselves stuck up in front of everybody else. And so I sent a runner back to old Tom Winter and said, look, the troops are around to our right rear. You better check up on what's happened to the Franco-Belgian, the Dimitrov, the Tailman. Well, whether it ever got there, I don't know. Anyway, I simply said to our fellow, look, get round the front. It's less coming from up here than we're over the bloody right. Get this bloody hill to our right and we were safe. So we edged round. And then Kit Conway got killed, doing his good shepherd walk miles ahead of everybody else with his walking stick. And he suddenly stopped and knelt down and got hold of his stick and his hand slid down and he went, and he was dead. So I took over number one company. And this went on for quite a time. And I got hold of three lads. One was a lad named Graham, very young lad, only about 22, who I said, look, you find out what's happened to number two company. I can't bloody well see any of them. There's all this mob that had arrived over and now got the other side of the bigger hill. There were two hills. Ours was a little one, and ours had a little white house on it. And there's the bigger one, not high, only about 12 foot high, but it was colour. It was all rocks. Well, these silly twits had all got on the other side of it, and they couldn't realise, see, that all the firing was coming from that side. Should have been on this side. Well, by now, things got out of hand. Those who weren't trying to get behind these two mounds were already running back, or else were dead or wounded. Among them was a little Jewish lad named Davidovich, who was a first aid lad. I saw him get hit with something or other. It must have been more than a bullet, because his whole bloody stomach fell out. And he just packed it in. Never seen anything like it. He was standing up there with his trousers dropped and his little old fat belly was all split open, and he was poking the bloody stuff in with his blood everywhere. And then got it all in, and he was still going round getting stretchers laid out. Anyway, it didn't last long. He couldn't stand it. So he got on a stretcher. Now, I got another one at that moment. I got one in the head here. And I thought, well, I've had it now, because everything went red. And I thought, well, this is how you die. I got knelt down and I called Sam Weil over. I wanted to give him me binoculars, you see. But he didn't come. Anyway, I said, I'll have to go back. So we put this lad on a stretcher and five of us. I hung on the edge because I didn't really know where I was going. And when we got to the wall, before we got to the wall, two of them were killed. So it left the lad in the stretcher, myself and two others. So they picked up one each end and got him over the wall. And I got over the wall. And it's at this moment we see the bloody machine gun company, who hadn't fired around all day, with Fry hiding behind a bloody wall. And all his 50 or 60 crew. We had 12 guns there, you know. Not a fire. I said, what the bloody hell happened to you? He said, we've got the wrong ammunition. I said, well, why haven't you gone and got the other ammunition? He looked a bit dumb. I drew him off a bloody strip and called them all and named him bloody hell. I said, you're responsible for this bloody slaughter out there. You know, if your guns were working, we could have stop this bloody bunch, because he was out of the way of this bunch now. He'd got behind the wall, and there was a bit of a bluff. It was out in the valley where they could see you. So away we went, and I picked up George Aitken. By now, I'd come to the conclusion this wasn't as bad as I thought it would. It was all blood that was pouring into my eyes, and actually, it was only a slit that just touched the bone. So I got it bandaged up, and then old George and I went and looked for the ammunition from the machine gun company. There were more bloody troops down here than there were up front. And I said, somebody's got to get these blokes back, you know, George. He said, it's too bloody late now, we'll have to wait till the night time. Then we found the ammunition in the truck. It was tipped in a ditch, and the driver had gone. He was drunk. He was already in the Vino place in that farmhouse. So we got a crowd of blokes and ourselves and gathered a number of boxes of ammunition, and back we went. It's funny how everybody has their own ideas of how they're going to die. I was always quite convinced I was going to die with a bullet through my stomach, and I thought it was awful. And if I could stop that, I'd do any bloody thing. I'd hide behind trees, even hold a bloody rock in my hands, you know, if I'm going forward. But I had an ammunition box, so I held that. I won't go to an ammunition box. I'm running at the same time, bloody bullets flying everywhere. And old George was going down, a little fella too. And we got there with our box of ammunition, and we spent our time loading up the machine guns. By now it was getting towards evening, 6 o'clock. And the darkness comes very quick in Spain, you know. And just as we got our machine guns all loaded up, a horde of bloody troops turned up on the other side. The valley was, it's only about a mile. It was a long line of Moorish troops with officers on horses, you know, flowing cloaks, red and blue, as if they were on a bloody Sunday parade, coming right across the valley. They thought it was money for old boot now. Now, the only people left out in the valley was Sam and his 40, my blokes, because they were hadn't been hit from this side. And I bawled out because they were in distance.
Did they still have the Maxim guns?
Oh, they didn't have a maximum gun. I had no gun. I had rifles. The maximum guns were behind the wall. We'd fly. Our guns had gone. Our Lewis guns had been taken away by Andrew Marty that night. So we became ordinary infantrymen with rifles. And I bawled out to Sam to retreat and get back in the olive grove. So back he came. And just as I watched him through my binoculars going back, just he got about 40 yards, he got a burst of bullets through his side. And I thought, bloody Sam's gone. But they picked him up and dragged him in. And then this mob arrived. By now I'd already taken over. Every time old Fry opened his mouth, I said, at least you have to bloody say, mate, the better, because when this is all over, you're going to get your bloody head chopped off. So he just sulked. And George and I generally took charge. I said, now look, this is what's got to happen. Not a bloody round's got to be fired. You get those bloody guns over the top of this wall and you point them down that hill, and when I say fire, you fire from the right to the left all together and keep going back and forth till there isn't a bloody thing left. So now you have faith in a good old bloody sailor, mate, and you're going to get the show of your life. You'll never see how many men you can kill in a short time. These are wonderful things you've got here. But don't fire until I say so. Because if you do, there's anti-tank guns over there. They'll blow us right out the bloody ground. They don't know we're here at the moment. So good luck. You haven't been noticed up to now. So we did. On they came. And, of course, the nearer they came, the more timid the bloody crowd got. They wanted to fire, they wanted to kill them, you know. I heard about Moors doing awful things to prison. I never mind about the effing Moors. Hold your fire. One kid said, I'll fire an F you too. So I got stuck into him. And we held on.
How close did they get?
They got to the bottom of the slope. See, the valley was flat and it had a slope, quite a steep slope, but it was all rock, hard to get up.
And so how far was that from
there? That would be about 50, 60 yards. And then we opened up. You never saw slaughter like it. It went down like corn. Mind you, fly, troops, Moors, half of them went down anyway, on principle, make out they were dead. And I said, you keep on bloody well firing. There's a lot of live bodies in that lot. None of them got back. And finally we stopped firing. And that was it. And the night came on. I said to Fry, take these bloody guns out from behind this wall and get them back in that olive grove. Dig one in behind each olive tree, so long as you've got a good field of fire, and stay there. But get to the top of the slope, because we're going to have troops in front here on this wall, and you're going to cover them from behind. And that's how we left them.
In reading and hearing about the war, I'm always puzzled by Fry. Was he incompetent, or was he suffering from what we would now call shell shock?
Couldn't have been bloody shell shock. You haven't been in the line more than 5 minutes, had he? After all, this is the first day you get shell shock after a year or more. And we never had much artillery fire even then. No. Fry was like most people. Everybody's frightened. But the fear got the top of him. He decided he got to the wrong place and didn't want to be there. And he also decided he didn't want to show it. So he just kind of froze where he was. Instead of sending the lads back to look for their own ammunition, left them all day behind that wall. Human beings are not going to run away from a nice quiet position if they can give one, especially if the commander says, stay here. Well, they're money for old boot, isn't it? No, because when he got taken prisoner the next day, Jock Cunningham turned up in the evening. He'd had the flu and got taken to some hospital because he'd just come back from Madrid, but he wouldn't stay and he came up the line. By this time, Tom Winterham had got lost. He was no longer controlling anything. He was getting further and further away, you know what I mean? He was still there and there was chits passing back and forth, but never saw Tom. Till George Aitken and I picked him up, sitting behind an olive tree with a wound in his eye. Well, we knew he shot himself. We weren't going to tell anybody else. But Tom went into hospital on the following day when I went in, because by now things had got out of hand. I got another bloody wound. All my wounds seemed to chip the edges. I got one on the elbow. And the one in the head was getting all blown up, and I was getting a headache, so the first thing, I have to go in the hospital. Of all people, by the way, Gal, a bloody Russian, turned up. And here was me with bandages everywhere, looking half dead. And somebody said who he is. Of course, they had to give him a name, more important, really, what I wasn't the battalion commander. They said, that's the battalion commander of the British, the interpreter, I think, a Bulgarian said. And he's badly wounded all over. And you know how they do. They always exaggerate. Anyway, I was slipped back. And when I got back, I found Tom Winterham and Sam Wilde down at Almeria, right on the south coast in the olive grove. Never had so many bloody oranges in my life. I turned up. I said, where's Sam? Oh, he's gone out. I said, well, I'm going to go out then. They were looking for a brothel. Of course, in Spain, a lovely brothel. Clean. Here was Sam, who ought to be lying flat on his back with one kidney torn to many pieces and bandages from there to there, looking for the brothel. When I picked him, I said, well, what do you expect to do when you get there? You won't be able to do anything, so bloody well get back, and don't be so daft, get back in the bloody hospital. So back we went. Now, I only stayed 2 days. And then I went back to the front. Tom was in a private ward with a pretty little Spanish girl. He had now, it had been decided because of this business, we weren't going to make publicity of it, that he'd got typhoid. He was isolated. The doctor was playing up hell because in Spain you don't have little girls in hospitals with officers, but he was a British officer. What did he do? I said, send her the bloody hell out of it. Tom said, Fred, don't do this on me. I said, look, Tom, you've got a bloody cheek. You and I know what you've done. I've only got to go out there and tell the bloke, and you've had it. I'm prepared to forget it. But get the bloody woman the hell out of here, because this is a religious problem. These people are very strict on women. They don't. That's why they have brothels. Ordinary girls are not messed around. They're guarded like gold, you know, and they're everywhere in Spain. Oh, dear. So he got rid of the girl. And I went back. And I arrived at the front, and now Jock Cunningham was the commander. This was in February 1937.
Yes. Which day of the Battle of Jarama was it that you left to go to hospital?
The second.
So were you still there when Fry's
oh, yes.
Were kept?
I was right there. Jock Cunningham came back on the first night. He and I spent that night getting all the blokes back from the bloody, you know, the farmhouse. They were all hiding in these bloody vats, the empty vats, of sleeping in there.
What, the fellows who ran away on the first day?
And I went in with Andrew Diamond. There was a deadly bloody silence in this huge kind of cavern with these big vats all around. And I said, I knew there were people there. You can sense when there's a lot of people. There's not perfect silence. Some like grunt and some groan, you know, there. But it's kind of muffled. I said, look, Andy, roll a few bloody hand grenades around these vats. I see who's in this bloody place. And immediately it was like Wembley Stadium. Over bloody 100 in there. I said, come on out, you silly bastards. I said, get outside and fall in. And have you got your rifles? I didn't have a bloody rifle. I said, all right, you go to old Hooky Walker, he's got a few. We've been collected. Lads killed, we collect their rifles. Before we retreated, and so they all got rifles, and we marched through. This is in the dark, at 2 a.m. And we placed all these blokes along that wall, overlooking the valley. Machine gun company was still there. And I said, look, get your bloody self back. Well, I told you last night, you started an argument, and you were not the commander. I said, well, here's the bloody commander, Jock Cunningham. He'll tell you to get back. So we left them, thinking they're going to come back. We planted all the blokes, and we were ready for the morning. In the morning, we turned up. It'd be about 6:30. And the first thing that happened was a youngster. There was a young lad, be about 18, good-looking kid. Come from Liverpool. Suddenly a face appeared above the wall, all blood. His bloody eyes had been gouged out. This is the fellow they said they'd heard during the night saying, Fred, come and help me, because the Moors are up to all the tricks, you know. Called people out in the dark and then slit their bloody throats too. Well, I wasn't there, so I didn't go. But we turn up in the morning, Jock, myself, young, Graham, Andy Diamond. These are names of fellows who were always to be found where the fighting was. And we were kind of getting things. And there was a bloody machine gun company. While I'm balling this bloke a strip, a tank turns around the corner in the sunken road, because we're on this side of sunken road, overlooking the road and down the slope to the wall. There's a few lads behind the wall. Sam Wild, his crowd, not him, he'd gone, but his and my 40 were there on the left behind the wall. And a machine gun company. This bloody tank turned up.
Whose tank?
Franco. Well, I'd never seen a tank before in my life, and my first instincts were a bloody wall around to get out. Jock said, Fred, the safest place when a tank arrives is as close as you can get to it, so run towards it. So we all ran, five of us ran close to the tank. It stopped. And here was us leaning up against this bloody tank. The gun was swiveling round. It fired about 2 rounds, then backed out again. Didn't even know we were there. So that was that. And then the next thing happened, there was a crowd of blokes came over from the right on the slope of the hill, singing the International. Thought, blimey, this is good. This would be the French come up to help us out. And they kept going, singing away, walked right in behind this bloody road. And when they reached the machine gun company, they were Franco's troops. They were Moors. They whipped them in. Within 3 minutes, they'd all gone, guns and all. Only one got killed, one lad trying to fight, and they just shot him on the spot. Fry led the bloody retreat. And that was that. They were taken prisoner. They didn't take any notes of us. They just got away with it, you see. not much we could have done anyway. We'd have shot our own bloke instead of them. So they got taken prisoner.
George Leeson, who was in that company, said that they weren't singing the International.
Well, I know bloody well they were, because I was there. And so did Jock know.
So,
and everybody else who's written a book on that incident have said the same thing. Only those who were in the company have said otherwise. Now, what are they saying? They're saying that troops came over the valley, up the hill, over the wall, and none of them saw them. None of the machine gun crews saw people coming. And if they did, they didn't fire a single bloody round. Why, one machine gun would have stopped the bloody lot of them long before they got there. Oh, no, they came from this way.
From the right?
Yeah. They came from where Franco's troops were, and they got our uniforms from blokes who were killed, you see, and put them on. We had a curious old field uniform with, elastic around the ankles and rope shoes and a kind of jumper thing, khaki and a beret, which was a very practical uniform. In fact, most countries followed it during the Second World War. Now, they were all taken prisoner. A year later, they were released on a swap round, and Fry came back. Now, I wasn't. I was in hospital with them because it got into 1938. Fry, in his first action, as soon as he got to the line, went straight over the bloody top and kept walking, and he got killed. They just shot him down. He committed suicide. Wasn't any doubt about Fry. He was a complete opposite to Nathan, who was the same type of big, handsome fellow, but with the courage of a bloody lion, frightened of nothing. The other fellow had the same build and everything, but was scared stiff, but full of bluff, a bit of a talker. You had plenty of them.
Why was Fry still in that position anyway?
In what position?
Where they were, on the second day.
Because it was a safe position. It was the only safe position in the bloody front, and he was going to stay there. And the blokes weren't agitating for him to carry out orders. Any human being that was, well, I'm here, he wants us to be here. It's safe, why not stay here? They didn't realise that if they hadn't have been taken by those blokes as prisoners, they'd have been blown out of the bloody ground as soon as the sun came out, because they knew where they were now. You don't lose nearly a battalion of troops without some pretty high up saying that we've got to whip this lot out. Anyway, they're talking prisoner. You have all kinds of funny incidents. Old George. I think his name was George Wright. Not the George Wright, the car. Big